We are all familiar with this staple of the comics page. I don't know if you read the comics page. I do. But this is just a classic form of it. Going back for decades, there's the grungy old man with a beard on a street corner holding up a sign stating, "The end is near." There's been just so many variations of that. Included in that will be a punchline or other visual that pokes fun at that message. Perhaps this zealot can't see that he's about to step in front of a truck because he's got his sign, "The end is near," up in front of his face. It's his end that is near. Ha, ha, ha. What a moron. We've seen lots of that over the years. The idea that most have of this phrase, "the end is near," is that it is part of the effort of killjoy Christians to convince others that the world will end at any moment. Well, it is part of our role as witnesses to speak of coming judgment. But the idea of the end being near is a little more complicated than that. For one thing, this declaration is consistently directed at believers in Scripture, not the world. It is believers who are told the end is near. And it is not given to encourage them to set dates for the Lord's return. Recently, Nathan and I had a very good time, kind of a hilarious time, really, looking up what ebooks about the future were the hot sellers on the Christian scene. We got on the Amazon, the ebooks, and we're like, okay, what's the top 20 titles for what people are buying in regard to the future and the end times? All but two books of the top 20 involved signs that the Lord was coming back very soon, say in a month or two. Okay. That's what those books were about. And people are just still buying those things up like crazy. And that's been going on for a long time, but that seems to be an insatiable desire of people to know what the latest is about how Jesus could be coming back next week. I guess eventually someone will be right. It will be for the wrong reasons, I'm sure, but eventually somebody will be right about the Lord's return. But the main point of knowing that the end is near is almost always lost in the midst of that kind of sensationalism. That truth is actually meant to inspire certain kinds of behavior among Christians. If you know about the blood moons, and there is one tonight, a blood moon. Did you come in all in a panic about that? All in an uproar? If you know about the blood moons, and you know about the year of Jubilee, and many other obscure things about what this or that month signifies in the Jewish calendar, but do not concentrate on what our verses here tell us, the end being near is of no profit to you. Yes, there is a lot of urgency from Peter and other biblical authors about this subject. The nearness of the end means something. But what it means is that our relationships with each other ought to glorify God. That's what it means. He would much rather that you forgive your brother and use your gifts to edify him than that you believe that Christ is just sure to return during this year's Feast of Booths. So let us get into the text with our first point, the urgency of interrelating in the church. And we are only taking the words, the end of all things is near, to begin. That's this point, the first point, the end of all things is near. Everything else will be part of our second point, which is the real meat of the matter. But that is not to say that it is not of great importance to understand this first phrase. The commands for our behavior flow out of understanding that the end is near. So what is the end of all things? Is it the end of the earth? No. Is it the end of human civilization? No. In fact, it is not literally the end of anything except the preparation for what comes next. That might have sounded a little confusing. Perhaps it would be better for us to think of the end as the goal. The Greek word telos. The goal is near. Or the consummation is near. It's a culmination of, and therefore it includes all that has come before. When somebody's saying that the end is near in this sense, it means what's been being driven at during all of this period is about to come to fruition. What Peter is meaning when he writes about all things, the end of all things is near, is all of the history of this world, which God has sovereignly planned and executed. He is thinking about the creation and the fall and the covenant with Abraham and the history of Israel and the redemptive work of Christ and the pouring out of the Spirit upon the church. Those are the all things. What all of that has been driving toward is near. So what is the end to which all of that is currently working? It's the redemption of this world. The redemption of this world. That will involve an outpouring of God's wrath upon wickedness. Redemption includes purification. We're going to be talking about that in Malachi. Redemption includes purification. That will be involved. It's a major element of the day of the Lord, of which the prophets spoke so much. That's part of the end coming. There will be judgment, as Peter has just affirmed in the previous verses that we looked at a couple of weeks ago. There is a man who stands ready to judge the living and the dead when the end comes. But this end also involves setting up a kingdom. It's the kingdom of the Messiah. It involves the glory of redeemed men ruling this earth. This is the salvation ready to be revealed in the last time, as we saw in chapter 1, verse 5. This is the revelation of Christ, as we saw in chapter 1, verse 7. This is the day of visitation that we read about in chapter 2, verse 11. That is what is coming near. The events surrounding the return of Christ and our glorification, that is the end of all things. They consummate God's plan for human history. Peter's declaration is that this final stage of God's timetable, God's plan for human history, this is near. It's actually a perfect tense in the Greek. this has come near. It has come near. It has drawn near. Peter's not saying that it is here. He's not saying that it would come soon. Not really talking about chronological, you know, right around the corner type thing. He's saying that in God's design for his people, there is no significant event that needs to take place before the end arrives. This is the idea of imminence. We've talked about this word before. This is I-M-M-I-N-E-N-C-E. I-M-M-I-N-E-N-C-E. There's other words that are like that. We've talked about that. But this is imminence. There is a fixed day in God's plan for the end to come. He has fixed that day, but we don't know that day. We are simply told to be ready for it. It is impending. We live in the knowledge that it could take place in any generation from our perspective. So many verses in the New Testament communicate this expectancy that we should live with. With one phrase or another, Romans chapter 13, verse 11, coming up to it soon in our study, say, do this knowing the time that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep, for now salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. Interesting phrase there. Salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. Wait a minute, I thought I was in my salvation when I believe. What do you mean salvation is nearer than when I believe? But of course, it's talking about the fullness of our salvation comes when the end comes. Glorification is extremely important to our salvation. It hasn't happened yet. But we're getting nearer. We should have a sense that it's getting nearer. And by the way, while we're here in Romans, there's quite a correspondence between Romans 12 and our 1 Peter passage for tonight. The things that we've been going through in Romans 12, while we're right next door here, we have a context of persecution in both. A context of allowing the Lord to be the avenger of wrongs. We haven't got to that part quite in Romans 12. But in the midst of that, the focus of the church is to be the use of our gifts. We had that at Romans 12. Prayer, we had that at Romans 12. Loving the brethren, Romans 12. Hospitality, Romans 12. All of these are going to be in our second point tonight, out of 1 Peter. And then you look at Romans 12 begins with our worship and service. Our passage tonight ends with that worshiping of God, our service. So I think our Wednesday night study is helping us to know how to act in the light of the end having come near. This is, we're going to see this in a moment in James as well. This is the common teaching and perspective of all the biblical authors. Why are we telling you about faithfulness and persecution in the light of the Lord's return? It is because we want you to see the importance of how you relate to each other. Well, Hebrews 1:2. Again, we're looking right now at phrases that tell us that the end is, it has come near, okay? We're in this interesting place in God's design for history. Hebrews 1:2. In these last days, God has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. In these last days, these are the last days before the end. Hebrews 9:26. Otherwise, he would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. From the time of Christ's first coming forward, we're in a time of the consummation of the ages that hasn't quite reached its end. Everything's getting kind of summed up here. 1 John 2:18. Children, it is the last hour. Wow. That seems even closer than days or, you know, something that's come near. It's the last hour. And just as you heard that Antichrist is coming, even now many Antichrists have appeared. From this we know it is the last hour. We keep getting this sense from Scripture. We're in this last time before the end comes. But perhaps the most interesting parallel of this phrase in Scripture is James 5:8. Just going back one letter here. James 5:8. And we were in this not terribly long ago. You too, be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. The coming of the Lord is near. Here we have the same verb in the same tense, has come near. The coming of the Lord has come near. So again, the return of the Lord to earth is what is in view with this end, with this goal, with this consummation of history. This is what has approached, and it could arrive at any time from our perspective. What is so instructive is how James uses this truth about the return of the Lord has come near, how he uses that in his letter. Thinking Romans 12, thinking about our own passage. Here he's encouraging his readers, and his readers were also Jewish, by the way. We've emphasized that with 1 Peter. James's readers were Jewish. Parallel there. He's encouraging them in the same manner as Peter. He has written about persecution in the previous verses. 5:1-6. Talking about the persecution of believers. He's affirmed the judgment of the oppressors. There's going to be a judgment for them. Just very much in line with these other passages. And now he tells his readers to be patient with the trials of this life, the difficulties, the suffering. Be patient with that. The judge who is going to put everything right, he's come near. He's ready. This day of judgment is going to take place. And then what does James do? He goes on to state what should be the primary effect on his readers of the nearness of the end. What should there be the response be to that? The brethren were to concentrate on the way that they were treating each other. There's an emphasis on prayer as you go on in James after saying, you know, the Lord is near. Prayer. There's an emphasis on loving behavior toward those who sin. We even have this same phrase about covering a multitude of sins to end his letter that we find in our Peter passage. They were on the same page with this about what it meant for the end to have come near. So as we move to our second point, we see the same urgency in these men of God. We need to live in the perspective of the end having come near. We should have a sense of privilege, a sense of excitement that in this age, we're so near to the culmination of God's plan. That knowledge should give us a passion. It should, but a passion for what? That's the question. That should excite us. Excite us for what? To do what? Is the point of this, make sure you get the timing of the day of visitation right? Is that what this is all about? Make sure you accurately predict when that's going to happen. Is that anywhere in any of this? No. The passion we're to have is a passion for relating to your fellow believers rightly. As the community of the faithful waits patiently for the end to arrive, we are compelled to serve one another. Because we're also going to give an account. The Lord is going to judge the unbelievers. But we are going to give an account as well. The Master did not say, when he was talking about this so much, giving parables and so on, the Master did not say that when he returns, he had better find out that we got the date right. Because there's going to be a whipping if you didn't read all the signs and get the blood moon and the jubilee and the feast of booths and all of that, get your act together and nail it. That's not what he cares about. He wants to find us doing what he commanded. So let's find out what those commands are. They involve our relationships here in the body. I've divided the rest of our verses into four instructions. The first is, be sober for prayer. Verse 7, be of sound judgment and sober spirit for the purpose of prayer. These two words for sound judgment and sober have to do with being sane, being under control. They are the opposite of an ecstatic state, of being overcome by emotions, spontaneous outbursts. This is the opposite of that. We can guess what Peter would think of the craziness that goes on in some sectors of the visible church, where there is no thought process behind the utterances being made. Prayer is not just opening the mouth and letting whatever rambling thoughts happen to enter the mind pour out. That has nothing to do with being of sound judgment and sober spirit for the purpose of prayer. The nearness of the end should rather cause Christians to be very thoughtful about matters for prayer. And Peter clearly has the corporate praying of God's people in mind. The verbs are plural. The word for prayer is plural. Get praying with each other. That's what the Lord coming near, the end having come near, that's what it should inspire. Your prayers together. Effective petitioners will consider what's most needed in these days of suffering from persecution and waiting for the Lord's return. What does that tell us about what's important to pray about? There will be prayers for endurance. You know, prayers for faithfulness in the face of evil. Faithful witness. Isn't that what they prayed about in Acts? Not, oh Lord, make it all go away. We're not supposed to be suffering. That your son took care of all of that. What's going on? No, it was, Lord, may we be faithful. Glorify yourself in what happens to us. There'll be intercessions for the brethren when you're sober. There will be prayers for grace to forgive injuries, mockery that might have come our way. There will be prayers for the effectiveness of our witness. There will be prayers about stewardship. so that we might give a good account when the Lord should appear. Boy, I just think that there needs to be a lot more praying about being a good steward in the church. There'll be prayers of praise for God's supply. There'll be prayers of adoration, such as the one that ends this passage. We will pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Because we're living in that anticipation, that hope. Each of us is responsible to contemplate with sound judgment what needs to be prayed about in the light of the approaching consummation of all things. Secondly, we keep fervent in our love. Verse 8, above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. And I'll note at this point that we have the phrase one another three times in three verses. When you see something like that, a little Bible study, counsel here, you see, the same phrase, same idea, same word, three times, right? Close. There's a point being made, okay? One another, one another, one another. That certainly clarifies the focus for us. The focus of our service to the Lord is fellow believers, even as we do witness to a watching world. That you can't in any way discount our witness to the unbelieving world. The focus is one another. That's the focus of the end having come near. Of course, Jesus himself said the greatest commandment on the horizontal level is for us to love one another. Isn't that the greatest witness? By this, they'll know that you're my followers. If you show love for one another, if you do the things that do that, everything else falls into place. That would be a subject for prayer too, obviously. Loving one another. All this works together, but here the exhortation, literally having fervent love, it's one of those instances where the participle having carries the weight of a command. And that Greek word behind fervent appears only here in the New Testament. It's the idea of stretching, straining. Have a love that stretches and strains toward one another. What Peter's saying is put some effort into your love. That will obviously mean being with the people that you are supposed to be loving. Am I right? It will mean interacting with them. It is, I would suggest, very hard to fervently love people that you hardly ever see or talk to. It's not going to happen. But being with others a lot means that we have to deal with everything about them, the negatives as well as the positives. Ooh, and we all have both, don't we? It won't be long before a given person in the church sins against you in some way. It won't be long before you sin against them. So love stretches. Love stretches further and further and forgives and bears with. We know God's word well enough to understand that Peter's not saying that we ignore sin that could have devastating consequences for an individual, for the church. We don't turn a blind eye to patterns of sin and deadly cancers that might be growing in the church. Church discipline is commanded regularly. We talk about that. But when a sin is not a constant pattern with someone, And when it's only ourselves that is sinned against, or maybe even just irritated, it's usually best to overlook it. It's usually best to cover it with love and grace. We could say that for Peter and his audience, this idea was proverbial because it came out of Proverbs. Proverbs 10:12. Hatred stirs up strife, but love covers all transgressions. That's what Peter's working off of. Love covers all transgressions. Proverbs 19:11. A man's discretion makes him slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook a transgression. It's a glorious thing. In many, many circumstances, not all, but in many circumstances, it's a glorious thing to overlook a transgression. There's something unattractive about someone who never lets an error, an unwise word, a fleshly act go by without calling it out. That's very tiresome, typically not helpful. Got to get on that. That spirit tends to engender further sin on both parties. And that's what Proverbs and Peter, I think, are getting at. You got to keep getting on everybody's problems, irritations, idiosyncrasies, etc. You're just going to provoke more than you're going to help tamp down. Love keeps the flesh from rising up to do even more damage. Clearly, we have a need for discernment here, and again, prayer sometimes. This is not an excuse to turn a blind eye as a person goes off into left field with obviously ungodly behavior. You know, we all have different personalities and so forth and can go out of balance with these kinds of things. We're not saying that at all. Hear what's being said. To never rebuke, that is not loving. We don't overlook every single transgression that we ever come across. We show some discernment. But what we're being reminded of is the truth of Colossians chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. So as those who have been chosen of God, holy and beloved, put on a heart of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving each other. Whoever has a complaint against anyone, just as the Lord forgave you, so also should you. That's the spirit. A forbearing, forgiving spirit. If I feel that I have to address something for somebody's good, for the church's good, for the purity of the church, etc., I will do that. But I can overlook transgressions against me. Our third command for our relationships is to be hospitable without complaint in verse 9. I don't think that needs a lot of explanation. We've spoken about what it means to be hospitable many times, including in our recent study of Romans 12. This would often involve opening one's home to other believers as the need arises. It just involves having what you have from God available to other people, reaching out to other people, welcoming other people. It's always interesting to have a behavior connected to a certain spirit or mindset. We saw that in Romans with the gifts. Here, be hospitable to one another without complaint. That without complaint there is, you know, it tells us what is the greatest danger of this good thing that you're supposed to be doing. What's the tendency when we're really trying to be hospitable? Well, the tendency can be to kind of see it as a burden. Tendency can be, you know, there's quite a few people who aren't doing their share. Okay, just honest, you know. I've had those kinds of thoughts. You have had those kinds of thoughts. And this is saying, watch out for that. Be hospitable without complaining about it. We focus on the Lord. And when we do, then we're ready to extend ourselves in that way with the right spirit. It's also worthwhile to think about how hospitality connects with the end being near. And I would say that the idea would be having a kingdom focus regarding our possessions. I think that's what this is getting at. We're more interested in what the master will say about our use of what he's given to us than preserving as much as possible for ourselves. That's the kingdom focus. It's not about right now and what I can get over these next very few years. We're looking to the reward of the future. We're not intent on feathering our nest in this present age, which is just passing away. The kingdom focus helps you with the laying up of treasures in heaven to be rewarded here on earth. It helps you with the best use of what you have to think about how the end has come near. Finally, we're to employ our giftedness. That fits well with the hospitality command. Both involve being good stewards of what God has graciously given to us. Be a good steward with each other. You've been given so much by the Lord. Think of the idea of being channels. What God has to give just going through us and into others. We studied our giftedness at length in Romans, so this is a supplement for us. Our gift should not be seen as one ability, but a spectrum of abilities. It's filtered through the personality, the background that God has given to us. There will be strong tendencies toward one or more of the gifts that are listed in the various places in the New Testament. But each believer is unique in the combination God gives. It says here that God's grace is manifold. What does that mean? Manifold literally means it's many-colored. Lots of shades and variations of giftedness. And as we were talking about in our membership class, we take our place along that rainbow, that many-colored rainbow of God's grace given to his people. What's important is not figuring out exactly how you're gifted, but serving others and allowing that giftedness to manifest itself. God will guide you to where you are most effective in the body. You can be certain of that. He takes charge of that. He says, I'll do that. I have things for you to do. I have effects for you to have in the body. Just follow me into service, explore, do what is coming before you. God works through all of that. Peter makes it clear, as does Paul, that each regenerate person has something to contribute. So be a good steward of what is ultimately God's. And that idea of stewardship certainly connects with this idea of the end having come near. It brings to mind all of those parables of Christ's return, where stewardship is the main issue. We will give an account of how we used our possessions, how we used our giftedness. So we seek to glorify God with who he has made us to be. And we see that there are two general divisions of giftedness here. There are those who need to speak a fair amount in order to be good stewards. That's just how God has made them. They have to talk a lot in order to get their giftedness out to the body. That teaching, leading, exhortation. Others are more on the serving side. Their helping actions speak loudly. We might well have an example of this as early as Acts chapter 6, where the apostles could not wait on tables. It's not that they were above that. We can't do tables. We're apostles. It was simply that in that context, there were those who were better suited for a ministry of meeting physical needs. The teachers needed to concentrate on what God had gifted them to do. That was of crucial importance to the church then. Others could do these other things. So we see that division there. As with hospitality, we have words of counsel for the enacting of the giftedness. Speakers need to be sure that they are communicating only what God has said in His Word. Tell people what God has said. Explain what He has said. This is not about your own thoughts. They're not going to bless anybody. The more personal meeting of the physical needs with the serving side, that was to be done in God's strength. You don't rely on your own resources for that. As we all serve one another in this way, God gets the glory, not man. It's His Word, it's His power that is sustaining the saints until the end comes. And how appropriate are those last words in the context? To Jesus belong the glory and dominion forever. That's where we're going. That's where history is going. No, we don't see this happening right now. Jesus is not in that position here. It's His due. It's His inheritance. It's been promised. It's going to happen, but it has not arrived. This very Lord's Supper tells us that. It's not arrived. And that truth should draw the community of the faithful together in expectation. It is near. It is in fact much nearer than it was at first. It's nearer than, a lot nearer than it was 2,000 years ago. So we should have that sign in one way or another. The end is near. But that should not be out on the street corner. That should be in here. We should be showing that sign to one another in ways large and small. That should take our minds off of ourselves and put them on the needs of others. And it should cause us to soberly prepare for that day that is coming.